This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our weekly series about inequality in the Baltimore region. Minority access to colleges and universities is growing, but a report issued a few weeks ago by the Georgetown Public Policy Institute shows that trend masks a mounting form of inequality in higher education. The American post-secondary system, the report says, quote, is a dual system of racially separate and unequal institutions, unquote. The report found that since 1995, 8 out of 10 white enrollments have been at what they called selective colleges and universities. About 7 out of 10 black and Hispanic enrollments were at 2- and 4-year so-called open access schools. Anthony Carnevale, co-author of the report, explained why it matters to students whether they go to a selective or open access school.
The selective schools charge more money, but they also spend more money on their students, approximately 3 to 5 times as much per student per year as you'll get in less selective schools. They offer a set of benefits that are several standards above the less selective schools.
Carnevale says there are plenty of black and Latino students qualified for the selective schools. They're just not getting in.
We number about 240,000 low-income and minority kids who are above average in their high school class on their college admission scores, but never get to go to a selective college. And when we look 8 years later, the vast majority of them have no degree at all.
Carnevale says his and other research shows that these students have SAT and ACT scores that give them an 80% chance of graduating from a selective institution. But those schools want 95% of students to graduate. They're not willing to take a chance on students with lower scores.
So in a way, selective colleges have competed their way in search of prestige into a place where, even though there are large numbers of students, minority and low income, who could do the work, they don't get to go.
This prestige arms race, Carnevale says, snaps up the students with the highest test scores, and he says they are almost always the ones whose parents have big bank accounts.
So it's a win-win for the colleges. If they get the kids with the high test scores, they also get the kids who can afford to go to the college. Truthfully, if they were trying to let in lower income kids in any large number, they would not be able to sustain themselves financially.
Anthony Carnevale is director of Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce. He spoke with senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us. With me now are three people involved in higher education in our region. Tracy Durant is part of the Associated Black Charities Advisory Committee for Higher Education Public Policy. Disclosure, ABC is one of the many funders of this series. She received a Ph.D. in education from Morgan State University in 2005. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
John Banks is an adjunct instructor and academic advisor at the Community College of Baltimore County. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And with us by phone is Joe Fisher, founder of First Generation College Bound. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
Now, Tracy, you went to Western High School
in
Baltimore. You serve on the Alumni Association. Western is a college preparatory high school. Given what we just heard about the Georgetown report, what kind of tracks do you see leading out of Western? I mean, how many students going to college? Where are they going?
I would say that it's probably changed some over the years, but Western probably still touts a 99% graduation rate and college going rate. So most of the students that go to Western are, in fact, going to college. I think where they're going now has changed somewhat. I think more of those students are going to career and technology types of schools. More of those students are probably going to more community colleges, and primarily because of funding. Because of money. College costs a lot more than it did, and a lot of the students just don't have or believe they don't have the financial resources to go to college and to be able to sustain for 4, and what we're now seeing is a 5-6 year graduation rate.
Joe Fisher, you have worked since 1990 with middle and high school kids whose parents did not go to college, mostly in Prince George's County. What are their specific needs when it comes to preparing for college and sticking with it?
Because of the misinformation that's out there, a lot of them don't realize they can go to college, and especially if they have a 2.0 or higher. They're dealing with a very, very challenging situation at home or in the community, and these kids are walking around with all this raw talent. but they're also being misinformed by other individuals in the community who don't realize the challenges these kids have, but they have a lot of raw talent to succeed in college. And without the proper information, with someone providing them the direction to get on the college-bound track in terms of their attitude and taking the SAT or the ACTs, beginning, we say, as early as 10th grade, and take the college-bound classes, it really puts them behind in the college-bound process.
So is it primarily a matter of attitude that they need to think of themselves as college-bound, and that will tend to get them into the right coursework in high school?
Yeah, that's a big issue. I once heard somebody say, you know what, we've got a I heard a sermon one time, and it said that, you know, you've got some people don't realize that they're in a group and they're an eagle, and there are a lot of people around that can't fly, but they can and don't know it. So if you're in a group and nobody's really letting you know you can fly, that's where you're going to stay. And we got a lot of kids in school who can fly, and they just need to really be encouraged with the right information.
Tracy wants to jump back in here.
Yeah, because I think that part of the issue is around advocacy. I don't think it is as much about attitude on the individual student. If we were to look at, and I can give you two examples. If we were to look at my own background and my own experience, one thing I will tell you is that I fit the statistic of the child that probably would not have gone to college, because I did come from a single parent home whose mom was ill, and I stayed with a lot of different family members. I did go to Western. It's the oldest all-girls school in the country. It is a phenomenal institution of learning. However, I did not rank in the top 20% of my class. I was a student who went to school every day, so I had perfect attendance and I was there every day, which we know are good indicators of college success. I did not score a high SAT score. I don't even remember what it was, but I know that I didn't get into UNBC or College Park. I can tell you that. I remember it vividly. So by all looking at me, I would not have been sitting here with a doctorate having this conversation. But part of that had to do with the advocacy. Part of that had to do with organizations or people in the schoolhouse who saw something in me and kind of pushed me through that. Now, my daughter, who comes from a very different situation, she does come from a two-parent household. We don't meet requirements for free and reduced lunch. I mean, that's just not where we are. She went to Christian school for all of her schooling until she went to high school. She is now in high school. She's a rising sophomore. She's taken honors classes. But just last year, when she was bringing home her schedule to me, she brought me a schedule that did not have her on track for where I know she needs to go to get into college. And I looked at the schedule and I said, you know, I need to meet with the counselor, because we need to backwards map. We need to begin with the end in mind. So the option of not taking a fourth math is not an option for her. So I had to look and I had to sit down with the counselor, and we had to map out the next 3 years of her academic career so that I know she's ready for a PSAT and SAT, so that she's on track for GT and AP courses, because I know that's what colleges look at. But our concern, our real work, is not for the children like my daughter who come from a home where her mom has that background. It's for the kids that don't. And that's
right.
Advocacy. That's not attitude.
And I know that's exactly what First Generation College Bound has been doing for the kids it works with, is that kind of advocacy. But John Banks, you want to get in?
I think we're touching on some things that are important. Attitude is important. Advocacy is important. But when you're talking about students coming to college, they need to understand the importance of self-advocacy. They need to understand that you have to be able to read, write, and count on college level. And a large number of the students that we see cannot do some or all of those things. So they come to college with a decided disadvantage because there wasn't a plan from the beginning to end up in college. And that's part of the problem that we're dealing with, is that students don't come prepared. Now, in addition to that, there are funding issues. Many of them are on financial aid, but some don't qualify for financial aid. They don't come with many don't even take the SATs and ACT. So what you see in terms of the report that you were referring to earlier is really a mask for something that's much more fundamental that did not happen at the middle school and high school level in terms of preparation and attitude for coming to college.
But that's not the student's fault. And I think the more you read those reports, when we talk about things like underpreparedness, that's not on the student. Underpreparedness are systemic and they are institutional. Those structures that we have in place that do not prepare students to go to college, there is no reason why, and you know, John and I have a similar experience in that I worked at CCBC in developmental education. And what I will tell you is there's no reason for a student to graduate from high school with a Maryland State diploma and enroll in any college having to take developmental courses. There is a disconnect between what students are learning and what they need to be successful in college. To put that onus on the student is unfair. What we need to do is take more time looking at the institutional systems that we have in place and the structural systems that keep perpetuating that kind of thing. Because when you have some districts in our state where 80% of the students that enroll at the community college are taking developmental math, that's a problem that is...
Developmental math is the same as remedial?
It is.
Okay.
The term that is used now is developmental.
The more polite term.
The more polite term. In a sense, remediation suggests that the students are getting a review of something they had. Developmental is suggesting that they may not have had it. I mean, if we're looking at math alone, 80% of students in certain districts in our state, those students are enrolling in developmental math, at least one level of developmental math, which means they are at least a semester from taking a college-level course. Well, if I graduate from high school, I shouldn't be taking developmental courses. There's a disconnect that isn't necessarily on me when we're talking about numbers like 80%.
I agree with you, but then the next issue is that the number one reason that students don't do well, in my experience, is that they don't show up to class. Well, that's a responsibility of the student.
On the college level.
At the college level. And then the second one is that they don't actually do the work. Well, showing up to class, doing the work, and then the third one, actually asking for help when you need it. And those are things that ought to be in the practice of any serious student. And a lot of students that we see simply don't come to college with those kinds of practices in place.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking about inequality in the higher education system with John Banks from the Community College of Baltimore County, Tracy Durant from Associated Black Charities Advisory Committee on Higher Education Public Policy, and Joe Fisher from First Generation College Bound. Joe.
I just want to say Tracy said something at the beginning of the show, which I think it was very important. When kids don't have the right college-bound strategy, going to a school where they fit, where they can achieve, and where they can afford, their chances of graduation is not very good either. And I think that's an issue, too. Because kids, they trust us as adults to lead them in the right path. And without that proper guidance, for example, they might end up going to a school where well, the funds come up short. They might get in, but they can't stay all 4 years because of affordability. But we try to send kids, we look at kids' SAT scores, and we try to get them out to institutions or colleges of higher learning where we know that they have the support services there where they can attend and graduate. We've sent 1,000, 1,300 kids off to college. We have 455 graduates, and we have 400. We got 300 that are still in college that we're keeping track of. And the reason that we've been successful is because we've tried to make sure they got the right financial support going to the institution and attending a college based on their academic profile as well. And that has really helped us. And I think that's really important. So I think that advocacy and with knowledge, knowing that these kids are putting strategies in place to go to a college where we know they're going to be okay, I think that's important. It's not guaranteed, but they're going to be in better shape than going somewhere where they're not really prepared.
John Banks, how many CCBC students finish an associate's degree or go on to a four-year school, and how long does it typically take them?
I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I do know that it is not the majority of the students who start, unfortunately.
So most who start don't either get an associate's degree or move on to a four-year school.
That is my understanding.
It's a different kind of question, though, because you have to ask why they come. People make the assumption that students roll in community college with the intent of getting a degree. Many of them do not.
Right.
Many of them want to get a certificate. Many of them want to get a, a specific skill for a specific job. So not everybody who comes, and that's the problem when you look at state data in terms of graduation rate, because not all of those students, if we looked at the number of students who intend to get a degree and the ones who actually do, that number is probably closer to the truth rather than looking at a cohort of people who come in and don't graduate, because some of them never come in with the intention of graduating.
And a lot of students are not clear about specific goals when they come in the first place. And one of the things that we do is help students identify what their goals are in that first semester. Because as Tracy suggested, not everybody's there for a degree. Not everybody is clear about what profession they would like to pursue. Mm-hmm. They don't know what they are good at or what would be something they would be in, they would enjoy as a profession, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road. And one of the things that we've observed is that if a student doesn't have a clear goal, particularly for African-American male students, if they are not clear about what their goal is, why they come to school, then it's very likely that they will not persist and they will not complete. And so one of the things that we do in the first semester is help them identify, well, what are some options that would be a good fit for you? And then what is a degree program or a certificate program that would take you from here to that goal?
We have to wrap this up, but before I let you all go, let me just ask each of you for a quick thought for, let's say, the parent of a high school sophomore who's listening to this and thinking, you know, my kid is, doesn't know quite what she wants to do, and she's not really applying herself, and she's, what's the crisp, helpful advice that you would want to put in her ear, that parent?
I heard a message several months ago that I actually use in my class, and a pastor named Charles Stanley said this. He said it's discipline and not desire that determines our success. And a lot of students come and say, I want this, I want this, I want that, but they don't come in with the discipline. And it really is all about having personal discipline.
Well, I would say, for me, if that parent has a child in 10th grade, you'd be surprised of the number of students who do not want to take the SATs because they think they're not prepared. I would recommend highly, number one, that the parent stay lifted, keep that child lifted and motivated to take the test and support that child no matter what, as far as taking the test. The SAT or the ACT is so critical. They would start that in 10th grade. I think that is important, as well as getting them to take as the highest math they possibly can to their potential. Because algebra 2 trig is critical in at least getting, and reading is too, but we have found for kids that come from socioeconomic situation that are challenging, that math has been the key because it's objective, not subjective, in terms of them making up for the reading on the SATs. And so the academic coursework, don't give up. You know, keep striving to keep them taking the high-level classes to go to college. And as well, take the SATs each year.
I would tell the parent to just continue to affirm the greatness in that child. And speak life to what they see in the child's life, you know, in terms of, you know, I see greatness in your future. I see you as a doctor. I see you as a lawyer. I see you as an engineer. I see you as a teacher, as a nurse, as a police officer. Whatever it is, find out what that child's interest in and just continue to speak life to it and start to expose that child to people who look like that child who've had success. Because many times students see the tree, they never see the roots. They never understand that there was a journey for us, you know, those of us who quote unquote made it. And so I think as many times as we can put children in a room with people who look like them that have had success, those things empower young people. And to start the college process now, take them to a local college. Even if you don't drive, have a car, you know, get on the bus, take them over to a college that's local and let them see and walk the campus. And you'd be amazed at what it sparks and ignites in a child.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Wonderful advice. Thank you so much, all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tracy Durant is part of the Associated Black Charities Advisory Committee for Higher Education Public Policy. Disclosure, ABC is one of the series' many funders. John Banks is adjunct professor and academic advisor at the Community College of Baltimore County. Joe Fisher is the founder of First Generation College Bound. At our website, we'll have a link to the Georgetown Report on Inequality in Higher Education. It's at mindsbetweenus.org. And while you're there, why don't you RSVP for our series' final public event? It's free on September 26th at the University of Maryland School of Social Work in downtown Baltimore. We're going to look back on what we learned about inequality in our region during this year-long series, and we'll tape a couple of panel discussions that will air as our final episode. Our featured guest is Nicole Hannah-Jones, an award-winning civil rights reporter with the investigative news outlet ProPublica. The evening will include questions from the audience. As I said, free and open to the public Thursday, September 26th at 6 p.m. Please RSVP at linesbetweenus.org. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, the month in movies. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.